Blog Talk Radio.
Country music this morning, as you can hear, because we're headed to Nashville today to talk to a very accomplished coach. You know, what is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis is Batman to your blank, okay? We got a guy on the show, and his name is a little bit of a puzzle, so we're going to let you figure that out, and we're probably going to tease the man a little bit and find out some great stories about Bill Riddle. From Nashville, Tennessee, he's a USTA, USPTA, PTR high-performance coach and coached some college tennis as well as now is the director of tennis at a country club. And we're going to talk about a variety of topics. Some of you already know kind of our standard questions, but Bill's going to bring a unique spin to the show. Here we are. Hello, Bill. Are you there?
Hey, how's it going? I'm here.
Doing good. You?
You know what? Doing good. A little chilly here in the south, but a great day with the sunshine.
Yeah. Well, I feel badly for y'all. You know, but we're having a very above average temperatures and dryness. So we have a drought coming in California, which of course is great for tennis.
Well, so, I think it was colder here than it was in Alaska this start of the week, which is never good, you know?
Oh, yeah, when you're losing to Alaska, you got to up your game there, for sure. Yeah, it's really kind of a historic thing, too. So anyway, that's good. We got the weather done. Excellent. So, Bill Riddle, what's the puzzle behind your name? What's the best joke that you've ever had based on your name?
Well, you know, sometimes you'll get that riddle me this with the Batman reference. That tends to be the one that you hear the most. But hey, that's the way it is, you know. It's all a joke.
Do you smile every time?
I do, man.
Okay.
You know, it could be worse. Have you ever heard of that? NASCAR racing is huge here in the South, and there's a race car driver, and his name is Dick Trickle.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I mean, you could have all kinds of different crazy names, but
you know what's funny?
Yeah.
As soon as you said it could be worse, I already thought of his name.
Yeah. You just kind of go there, whether you know NASCAR or not, don't you?
Yeah, that's NASCAR. All right. So, Bill, tell us a little bit about you and growing up and learning how to play tennis.
Well, you know, I guess I took the road that was maybe a little less traveled. I wasn't necessarily a tennis player in the making because I grew up in the country out here in outside of Nashville. And you know, when you grow up and across the street from your house is a tobacco field. You know, it just doesn't ring out, hey, you're going to be a tennis player. And so I kind of started with Dad's old Jack Kramer wooden racket hitting balls on the side of the house. And we had two tennis courts in the county, you know, when I grew up out this way. So, I mean, it was a little bit different. You know, I didn't grow up in a club. Grew up playing a lot of other sports, which, you know, I look back on it now and I was very fortunate because, you know, I still have a love for the game of tennis still today at the age of, we'll call it mid-40s. And, you know, having played all the other sports, I think that it allowed me to be a little bit more of an athlete than just a one-dimensional tennis player. So, you know, I kind of look back and think, you know, it was the best thing for me at the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting thread that I'm hearing more and more from people of our generation and earlier. And I'm older than you, so I'm 50, so you can just say how old you are. It's all right.
Say 44 is not bad, you know.
I don't even know what that means. But anyway, yeah, people who have a greater appreciation for what they have because they weren't handed a whole lot, you know, and hitting on the wall. It's kind of an amazing thing how many people that I interview spent such a significant amount of time alone hitting against an inanimate object.
Well, so, I've said this before in some other circles and whatnot, but you know, if I was ever promoted as czar of tennis worldwide, I would try to put up as many hitting walls around clubs and facilities as I possibly could, because you know, you're right. You think back to when we were kids. I mean, most everybody, you know, you didn't go to the club and you didn't have tons of lessons. And even during the boom, I mean, it was still a different time. And you went and you hit on the wall and you just kind of figured things out. And you learned a little bit about tennis the old-fashioned way. And gosh, I think it makes a big difference. And that would be the thing I would do, is try to create more opportunities through just, you know, kids being able to get out and just hit some balls on the wall, man.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's interesting. Let me know when you start making an effort to become czar, and I'll try to get behind you. So,
I mean, yeah, I don't see it happening, but, you know, a man can dream, right?
Right, yeah. I would try to redirect you on that maybe a little bit. But, right, so then when you started really, what kind of unlocked it for you so that you would be out there and start playing tournaments and all that, and you got engaged with the larger community?
Well, it was funny because I grew up and, you know, I was going to play college football. I mean, that was my goal, and that was kind of the dream. And senior year of high school, I had a car wreck, and, at that time, it was a head-on collision, and I was very fortunate to walk away from the accident. Actually, I didn't walk away. They took me away in an ambulance. But days later, I walked, and you know, I was just not going to be able to play football again, and had always played tennis as one of those, you know, three or four different sports, you know, growing up, and found myself back, you know, hitting balls and kind of redirected a little bit, and just funny chain of events kind of happened, and you know, I found myself playing a few tournaments, got a job at a club, and you know, a few months after I'm there, the tennis director leaves, and they were going to look for somebody new, and I wound up filling that job for them for 5 years. So it was just kind of funny how, you know, I guess I knew enough to get by, and not enough to you know, make any mistake, big mistakes, and you know, maybe there was a bigger plan for me, but just kind of found myself into tennis, probably down a different path than most people, and you know, so thankful that all those things happened the way it did, because I mean, now, you know, after 26 years in the game and in the industry, I just couldn't imagine myself doing anything other than, you know, coaching and teaching and most importantly, promoting the sport of tennis, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I think the thing that teaches me too, and it's good for coaches to keep these kids who play peripherally connected somehow, you know? I mean, I've had lots of kids who played multiple sports and tennis was their second or their third favorite, because you never know when they're going to have their epiphany and or...
Right.
You know, an experience like you had, hopefully they won't, but you know, really decide, hey, now I want to play tennis because I'm sick of soccer, you know, I'm sick of this, I'm sick of that, you know, and you know, that's a great thing. It's good that you had that, you know, connection still. So somebody helped bridge that gap, I guess. So now,
yeah.
for for your playing, who were your influential coaches that helped you along?
Well, you know, I guess, once again, I'm a little non-traditional in this respect, in that for me, you know, not necessarily having a tennis coach and fitness coach and stretching coach like kids do nowadays. You know, some of them have a serving coach and then a forehand coach, and you and I see some crazy stuff out there. You know, I had three guys that were real important to my upbringing in sports, and it's odd, but Jerry Kirby and Terry Hementoler were both line coaches in football, and I worked with those guys when I was playing football in middle school, and, you know, even though those two guys never hit a tennis ball in their life, they really taught me more about just, you know, hard work and just dedication to whatever you're doing. And, you know, and it was more about life lessons, which, you know, you hear that talked about a lot of times in tennis, that, you know, you're not necessarily teaching tennis, you're teaching a lifetime sport and a lifetime skill and lifetime lessons. And you know, I thought about that today, just kind of reflected back that, you know, those were guys that were just instrumental in what, you know, what I've become and dedicated to the game of tennis and growing it. And there was one coach in middle school, Coach Presley, who cut me from basketball because I just wasn't athletic enough. And, you know, I can still see this guy's face. And what's funny is I've seen him many times since being an adult, and I think he probably taught me more than anything by cutting me and saying I wasn't athletic enough to play basketball in middle school. And, you know, I just found myself being, you know, working to become a better athlete. And I think, you know, in my opinion, if you're a good athlete, you can play a lot of different things. And sometimes I think we don't nowadays, we just don't have kids that are as athletic. And that's really stuck with me a lot. Those three guys were instrumental to me.
Yeah, no, you know, that's outstanding. And I think I've seen over the years a lowering of the bar, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bar used to be high, and you had to try to jump over it. And sometimes if you could just reach it and get your fingertip on it, then you were happy, you know.
Yeah.
No, I remember having PE coaches who just had, you know, crazy workouts for us to do and left you spent. And, you know, when you're a kid, you hated it, but then you realize now how great that was for you, you know. And then, but now today, kids in so-called physical education don't even exercise, really.
Yeah, it's frustrating. It's one of those things where
Lawrence, that's an abomination, right? So
yeah, it's hurting us.
So, you know, so I'm a big believer in raising the bar, and I think that has been something that, you know, people discount the value of getting fired, getting cut, facing adversity, and having to respond. People are more resilient than we give them credit for. So now,
right.
Was there anything, now besides like the hard work and determination that you got from these coaches, what would you say is another kind of different life lesson that they taught besides that? Was there anything specific?
Well, you know, as an offensive lineman, it's all about teamwork. You know, as a team sport player, it's all about working with the guy beside of you, the guy in front of you, behind you, you know, on a football team or a baseball team or soccer. I mean, you know, that ability to work together, and as you know, that sometimes is lost in the tennis business or tennis industry with a lot of different organizations and associations, and it's the alphabet soup and who controls this and who controls that. And you know, I think a lot of times we could definitely grow our sport and make things better if all of us did work together, which, you know, maybe is one of those life lessons and skills that maybe people aren't learning as much anymore, or maybe there's not an opportunity for them to learn that. But, you know, for me, you know, learning to be part of a team and know your role on the team, you know, do your job on the team, you know, work to work your way up to becoming the leader. You know, those are things that go a long way. And, you know, sometimes I think the kids nowadays, you know, they want to be the team captain before they are prepared to be that. And, you know, I think those are some of the things that we learned years ago. And for me, I think it's been hugely beneficial. So.
Yeah. Now, you know, I think we see a trend towards more team competition, and yet, I think, and especially here in NorCal, I've seen a lot of smiling faces on kids that are pretty high level juniors, but they just seem to really beam when they're in a team environment. We had an example recently. I didn't go to this event, but I saw the pictures and I liked it, where they took some of the top kids and they had a doubles tournament for them, and they encouraged the kids to come up with their own unique uniforms. And some
That's
of them
cool.
were just goofy, you know, but you could tell the kids loved it, you know, that they got to wear their Batman cape while playing doubles.
Right.
You know,
right.
or what have you. You know, I mean, they had these really cool T-shirt designs, and some of them tried to look really nice, and some of them tried to look really crazy. But the joy of that was palpable. So, yeah.
I would love to see us do, you know, do more team events, whether it be, you know, I know there's USTA events out there like intersectionals and zonals and whatnot, and that's for the elite players and the stronger players in each section and state. But, you know, junior team tennis, I think, is one of those hidden treasures that's out there. You know, high school tennis, that have no cut policies. I think those are desperately needed. You know, just middle school tennis. It surprises me how many cities and towns and counties around our great states here, they don't offer or don't have middle school tennis. And you know, I mean, how cheap you can actually offer and run a middle school tennis team. And it's just, you know, I would love to see us be able to have more of those opportunities, because, you know, that's where those kids are going to get the opportunities. That's where they're going to build those friendships and camaraderie and also learn from each other.
You know, I'll go you one more. Okay, let's picture a pro who's in kind of an isolated area and they're frustrated because it's so hard to build something. All they have to do is do exactly that. Form a
right.
one-day-a-week drop-in for middle school kids, and if you have six kids, then you have three teams of two.
Right.
Right?
There you go.
And if
yeah.
you have nine kids, then you have three teams of three, and if you have, you know, I'll stop there, but
yeah.
Or, and then you can maybe, if you have three different middle schools and you get that critical mass where each team has four kids, then you can have a flexible format based on how they match up week to week and do a little six-week season.
Right.
Yeah, I love those things. I've actually been on the ground floor of starting two different middle school leagues like that. And,
oh, wow.
And then the USTA came to us to say, oh, we want to make this a USTA thing. And we said, no, we want to keep it less expensive. And we
yeah,
want to run it our way. So
yeah, that's one of those things that
you,
happens. It's
no, thank you.
You know that, and as much good as the USTA does, unfortunately, I think sometimes there are some situations like that where they hinder growth, and it's unfortunate. But yeah, if we could offer more team competitions and opportunities, and you know, and I'll go one better and. Why can't we have some coaching at those levels on court? You know, I know the USTA is against coaching junior tennis on court, but, you know, as soon as these kids move to the college ranks at every level, they're going to get coaches on the court. When they get good enough to make it to a zonal team or an intersectional team, they're going to get coaching on the court. So that's one of those things that always kind of baffled me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, so to have special events that allow that, that's a good
right.
thing. I'm in the middle of writing a book called The Art of Coaching High School Tennis. And in it, you know, I kind of get into the whole idea of that elite juniors really ought to support high school tennis because they're going to get a unique experience and they're going to make new friends. And if they buy into it, then they make it better and then it becomes more attractive. And then they also have an influence on more kids around them. You know, so like here's a scenario. You have a kid and he's ranked top 20 and he's a junior and he comes and he plays on the team and then some new freshman comes on the team. And they see that kid, and they say, oh, I want to be like Jonas, you know. And then they get the bug. And then you know, 3 years later, that kid's college bound to play tennis. You know, but no, the elite player, the high school's not worth their time, and so they're going to skip it and go to their private coach. You know, so... you know, one at a time, I think we can reach people and get people to buy into that. And I, you know, obviously there are some situations where players require a little flexibility. So that's, that, you know, I think that some flexibility needs to be shown. Anyway, let's talk about your coaching philosophy. What are kind of your fundamentals that you begin with when you get some new players on the court?
Well, for me, you know, to me, coaching philosophy and philosophy in life is very similar. It, you know, I want people who come out to enjoy being out there, and you know, way too often, you know, you talk about the serious player, the elite player, the junior that's trying to make it to college, and you know, sometimes you just don't see enjoyment. Out there on the court, you know, they're so focused that they cross that line, and you know, then it starts to become you know, downhill, or they're struggling, and you know, for me, if you're not enjoying it, and it's hard to enjoy, you know, getting up and doing a 7 a.m. workout, or you know, 100 ball rallies, or you know, planks and things like that, but the idea of just enjoying the fact that you're playing tennis. You know, competing, you have the ability to do that. For me, that's kind of first and foremost. You know, I always encourage, and we stress just working hard, you know, and I think that's probably in everybody's, you know, top two or top three of their top 10 list. But then kind of third for me is probably just working smart too. And there's a big difference in working hard and working smart. And it's one of those life lessons, I guess, I picked up from my dad many, many years ago that crosses all boundaries, whether it's talking about work or, you know, your professional career or tennis. And it's just, you know, find ways to work smarter on the court, you know, and I think those are kind of key for me.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they're fairly general, because I think that people make up their own smartness. So, but to I think it's good to stop and really think about what you're doing, and you know, look at it and go, okay, look, what do I want to achieve, and have I built into my practice time, my workout time with the kids, every little thing that I want to do, and is it all scheduled in? You know, so, you know, like the mental game. I make sure that I teach something about the mental game every day. They're going to get a little 5-minute thing on that. So, because that's so key to unlock the mentality of how to learn, how to perform, you know, all that stuff. So, all right, let's move on to the next thing. I know in the pregame here we were talking about special events, and so this one's, I think, more for club pros or people who are influential at their club to get some new and exciting experiences going. So tell us a little bit about your special events, and then how about give us some general advice for how people can spice things up.
Well, you know, I've been very fortunate. Here in Nashville, we have an event called the Music City Tennis Invitational, and it's this year marks the 41st year in a row that this tennis tournament has been played. And you know, it started here in Music City, right off of Music Row, and you know, its roots are based with you know, people like Kenny Rogers and Minnie Pearl, and a lot of you know, influential singers and songwriters and producers from you know, the country music scene from years ago. You know, Pat Sajak even played it years ago, and John Siegenthaler. So I mean, it's been something that's been around the Nashville scene for a long time, and got started really to just kind of bring country music tennis players together. And what happened was it just kept working and kept growing. And about 15 years ago or so, I got involved and became one of the co-chairs and started running the tournament for them and serve as their tournament director. And you know, we've continued on with this event, and it's grown into more of an event than just a tennis tournament. You know, the first year they got together was, you know, 30 or 40 people back in 1973 playing, and they raised you know, about $1,800, and that was great. And now we're consistently raising over $100,000 annually. We've done $2 million in the last 40 years that we've donated to local charities in the Nashville area. And you know, for us, you know, when I got involved with it, I said, guys, you know, this has got great bones, but one of the things I think we needed to look at is making it more than just a tennis tournament, making it an event. And you know, I kind of reflect back to every time I go to Flushing Meadows and I walk on the grounds of the U.S. Open. You know, you walk out there and you see all the vendors and the shops and the food, and you've got, you know, concert, you know, you got somebody singing a little concert, acoustic guitar over in the corner, and you've got games going on over here and there. I mean, it becomes, you know, an event more than just going to watch a match. And, you know, I think a lot of tennis pros in general, facility managers, you know, they could learn something from that model, whether they've got a little tournament they're doing at their club or facility. You know, take what you're doing and look at ways to maybe turn it into an event that's more than just an A to B tennis tournament or a half day event. You know, you turn it into something that's a little bit bigger. You know, for us, what we do is we're kicking off actually this weekend. We have a little tennis pro cook-off, a little challenge where we got some tennis pros coming together at my club to do some cooking for charity, which allows us to kind of whet people's appetite about the Music City event coming up in April. You know, then we follow up in February and March with songwriter showcases, all of it kind of leading up to the main event, which is our tournament weekend in April, the weekend of April 26th here in Nashville. And you know, on that weekend we have Friday through Sunday we have a pro-am, we have a player kickoff party, we do a one-day tournament simultaneously, we do a two-day tournament for teams, and then we have a big player party on Saturday night. So it's a bunch of little pieces, but when you put it all together, it's this big, nice, pretty picture, and it is more of an event. And you know, when I talk to pros around the country, it's trying to get them into that mindset of not just a tennis tournament, because you know, sponsors don't want to sponsor just a tennis tournament. They want to sponsor an event. You know, they want to know that it's got some pizzazz to it. And that's a hard way of thinking sometimes, and you have to kind of retrain your brain. But you know, if you really want to grow your tennis tournament, you kind of have to start thinking, you know, I mean, we're not going to get to the level of the U.S. Open, but you know what? I mean, they've got a model there for you. And other events, whether it be the Super Bowl or the SEC Championship, you know, it's not just a football game. It's the fan experience, you know.
Yeah.
You look at soccer, they've got the same thing happening. So, you know, I think you can look at other events or activities or sports and take what they do and incorporate what you can into what you're trying to put on.
You know, well, okay, so it sounds like step one, get crazy like Bill.
Yeah, I think that's the key to it.
Just be a little crazy. Don't just go with what they hand you. You know, you know what's funny? I one of my life's problems is that I did not color inside of the lines, and I always hated that. I always hated the lines. And
I'm kind of right there with you, man. And they gave you like four colors. Well, you had to kind of make some new colors. You had to mix them together and create something new. You know.
Exactly.
You can't just do
what
blue, red, and yellow.
Yeah, I'm not fitting into your little round hole. I am the square peg. But so yeah, get a little crazy. You know, it's funny. I think even if you don't go the way of adding a whole lot of bells and whistles, just simply going out to be engaging at your tournament so that people feel like they've joined your family for the weekend. It's funny that you say that because
our people say it's like coming home to see friends and family every single year. We have people that come back to our tournament that physically can't play tennis anymore. They've gotten to an age or a certain level where they can't play in the tournament, but they want to come and just hang around with everybody and go to the party, watch tennis, you know, hit the silent auction, listen to the music, whatever it may be. They want to be in that environment for those 3 days. And, I mean, that to me, that speaks volumes to what you know, the committee and I do in our one little event here in our little corner of the world, you know.
Exactly. Okay, so we got about 15 minutes left here. And I think we want to go on to two different topics, so we'll try to manage that. Let's talk for a little bit about transition ball training, and you put the good, the bad, and the ugly. So,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit about transition, what your take on transition balls, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Well, you know, for me, I guess I, once again, just very lucky here in that, you know, early on in my career, back in the early 90s, I did a good bit of traveling overseas into Europe and whatnot, and you know, you'd see in Holland and Belgium, you know, facilities and coaches and whatnot, they're using transition balls over there and in England and whatnot. And, you know, so for me, I got introduced to it a whole lot earlier than maybe some others. And, you know, so it's always kind of stuck with me. And not that we had those resources back here in the States until, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, but it was always kind of, you know, a part of my teaching and coaching and philosophy. But, you know, for me, I'm a firm believer in utilizing all that you have at your disposal to, you know, help your student, help that player move from, you know, one level up to the next. And whether it be transition balls or, you know, better use of physical exercises, whatever it may be. I mean, you're trying to use all those resources to help that player out. And, you know, transition balls, I mean, just because you and I learned with a wooden racket with, you know, I don't know that they made anything other than a 4 5/8 grip back in those days, but just because we learned with a wooden racket and a yellow ball doesn't mean that that's what we should be doing right now. I mean, yeah, we were able to turn into pretty decent players and have careers in tennis, but you know that you can go a different route. It doesn't have to be the same way as when we grew up. So for me, I'm a strongly in favor of using transition balls. And the thing that bothers me a little bit is that, you know, I know the USTA is putting a ton of money into growing the game through transition balls. And you know, it's 10 and under, it's quick start, you got all these different names, and it usually changes every year to the tune of a couple million bucks, but it's all the same. But all of us, you know, whether you're in Nashville or the West Coast or up north, we're not necessarily all on the same page. And when it comes to, you know, what ages play with which ball and whatnot, and that's the thing that kind of frustrates me from a coaching standpoint is that, you know, I feel like if we're going to do this, and I'm in favor of transition balls and quick start tennis or whatever you want to call it in your area, but whether you're in favor or you're not, it's hard to really get the players and the parents and the people involved if we're not all on the same page. Because, you know, you have somebody who moves into your area from Chicago, and they do it one way up there, and you guys do it a different way out that way. And so it's a bit confusing to the consumer. So
yeah.
I don't know the right answer, but I know we need to be closer to the same.
Yeah, I want to make a comment and then move away from the topic. My thing is that more was not done at the beginning to build enough consensus, and now you have a splinter group of elite level pros who want nothing to do with it, and disenfranchising,
right.
Disenfranchising any elite level pros is not a good idea, but the national governing body has a long history of doing that. So I would advise anybody who's in leadership to really strongly consider whether they want to kill the golden goose or not. Let's
right.
move on, though, now that I said my thing and you don't get to comment on my show.
it's your show, man. I'm just along for the ride, man.
Yeah. It's a little bumpy, and you might have to spend some time in the trunk. All right.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something you can probably relate to. It's hard to look cool in the back of a pickup truck.
Well, not if you're in Nashville, though, dude. If you're in Nashville, you look good in a pickup.
In the back of the pickup?
Yeah, because back there you've got, you know, you're sitting on a hay bale, you've got your Jack Daniels you're sipping on, and straw in your teeth. And that's just kind of how
okay.
we roll down here, man.
It's a different world. Different world.
It's a different world.
Same country, different country.
That's it.
Oh, I don't know if you've heard this one. Guy leaves California. He's driving really fast. He enters Arizona. Arizona state trooper pulls him over and says, "Now, sir, I realize that you have just left California, but you have now driven into the United States of America." Okay. Coach,
yeah.
So let's talk
yeah.
about transitions from junior tennis to college tennis. What nobody tells you. What are we not hearing?
Well, my experience has been that, you know, tennis pros, for whatever reason, are a bit disconnected from, you know, they work with you up until a point, and then there's kind of this drop-off, unfortunately, and it's hard to bridge that gap into college tennis. I think where we're missing the boat, you know, and you constantly hear how, you know, there's too many foreign players that are coming over and taking our tennis scholarships and playing and taking spots. Well, the reality is we've got a lot of great junior players at every kind of level here in the United States, but we're not helping them into that next level of tennis, which is college tennis. And what we're missing is we're not educating them on what is out there. You know, that D3 tennis is still some pretty darn amazing tennis at a bunch of different schools. That
yeah.
that NAIA is man. I mean, there's some NAIA teams that we ran into that would put a hurting on some D1 programs. You know, so there's lots of levels of tennis out there. And there's a lot of opportunities that just go by the wayside because, you know, our kids don't know, our pros, our teaching pros that, you know, are supposed to be giving us all this information and making my forehand better. That's great, they do, but they're not helping me make that connection to the next step. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that's hurting us. I don't know that, you know, as soon as you say that, the USGA is going to want to try to get involved. And I don't know that that's something they can do or should be doing, but I think there needs to be better education to our teaching pros at clubs around the country. There needs to be a stronger connection between all levels of college coaches, you know, and the local pros. I think one of the proudest I've ever been was being able to make it, win our conference, win our region, when I was coaching college tennis at the NAIA level, and four of my top seven girls not only were they American, but they were from my backyard. You know, they were just girls from the Middle Tennessee area, and to be able to do that.
Do
what now?
I thought it sounded like you dug them up in the backyard.
Well, we kind of did, but being able to do that with local, with American players that were local, to me was not only a nice accomplishment, but it sure was a heck of a lot of fun too. So I would love to see us be able to do that.
Well, and you know, hopefully every coach is really striving to bring in the local talent, you know, most of all.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, you know, the whole how different schools appeal to different players and or, you know, really are striving to build their university culture in a certain way. So sometimes that runs counter to bringing in the local player.
Right.
But most colleges probably bypass some good local talent. I think that there's probably some high school level kids that are good enough to be high ranked juniors, but they just aren't interested in spending every weekend on the road, and they're overlooked too. And I think it would be great if college coaches really looked to the high schools to try to find that little diamond in the rough. There's some great kids that were like really good athletes, and if somebody gave them a shot, then you know, they'd be a really good player and a team player for them.
Right.
And
I totally agree. There's a lot of kids that are just under the radar for whatever reason, whether it be, you know, financially couldn't travel to the national events or the regional events or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of talent that's out there that just under the surface, just under the radar, that, man, you give them an opportunity and you can be pleasantly surprised.
Well, you know, one thing about high school tennis is that cheaters win 90% less matches, because in high school it's a lot harder to cheat. So high school tennis with your coach watching and a whole bunch of people on the court, and you could put lines people out there right now, the matches are so much more honest and fair. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So
not like college.
So we have just a couple of minutes here, and now it's time to wrap it up. So from this conversation, what would you say you would like people to take home, you know, two or three quick points?
Well, I mean, I guess first and foremost, I want them to come down to Nashville and play in our Music City event in April. But outside of that, I mean, I want them to know that you know, enjoying the sport at whatever level you're playing, finding a true enjoyment of being out there on the court hitting balls is probably one of the keys. You know, those juniors that are out there, those coaches that are out there working with these junior players, you know, finding ways to instill hard work and opportunities to work smart when they're on the court. You know, to me, that's the thing that I'd love to be able to pass on. You know, kind of my takeaway from what we were able to talk about today.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'll make you an offer. If you fly me out there, I'll treat you to some Bill Patton West Coast barbecue.
You know what? I might have to take you up on that now.
I can barbecue some chicken for you. Yeah, I'll even use my barbecue voice like I just did right there. So we got some good
we'll do a show from
out
our
here
event
on the as well. So, all right. Hey. Thanks for coming on the show. This was a real slam-bang interview, Bill. Great to talk to you and to get to know you a little bit. And, you know, I feel like it was like I just got to know you a little, and maybe our paths will cross at some point.
You know what? Tennis is a very small world, so I'm sure I'm going to see you on a court or somewhere down the road here soon.
Exactly. Tell you what, give me an email address that people can email you to find out about how they can play tennis with their favorite country western star.
Well, they could reach me at tennisun@aol.com. That's tennisun@aol.com. And I really appreciate the time being on here with you, and look forward to hearing more of your shows, man.
All right, very good. Thank you so much for coming on. Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. All right. Well, we put that together this morning, and, yeah, wow. So I think it's really interesting how, right there, how there's so many similarities to what Bill's saying to what a lot of the things that happen on this show. And, you know, I want to keep hammering that point, you know, that it really is about the enjoyment, you know, and as like Torben was saying on the show, you know, finding those precious things, the precious moments, and really paying attention to them. I just wanted to give you an update on that. I've been doing a lot of the one ball rallying and drill, and it's been really truly amazing to see my students take more time to consider what they're doing, because the next ball isn't coming right away. If somebody missed, then they missed, and somebody has to pick up the ball. But now we have a moment to reflect on why was there a miss, and then I'm noticing that my students are now rallying, 10 to 25 to maybe 50% longer, because they're taking more care with that rally. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. This is going to show up on a future date. But as I stumble around here, I will leave you with this.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.